Lean into your trailblazers. These are like the most curious ones out there, right? They are leaning in, they are creating, they are seeing the problems and beginning to build these GPTs. Make them shine. I believe that they are the ones that are going to inspire others. No, they're going to drive momentum. And when others see what they can do and how it can truly help not just the business, but their own work, hey, it's making me faster. I'm more effective, not just efficient. I'm actually innovating because I'm now thinking about the workflows in different ways.
This is Revenue Makers, the podcast by Sixth Sense, investigating successful revenue strategies that pushed companies ahead. Hey, Adam.
Yes.
How many agents do you have on your team?
612.
Okay. That might be a little bit more than you can actually control.
You know what? We've got a couple and we're working on some more. It's a lot of fun actually to do that.
It is fun. And we're really finding efficiencies. I think we've spoken on this podcast about how our BDR team has been completely transformed by our use of agents on that side. But just in our day-to-day for marketing, we've really leaned in. And today's guest, Lisa Adams, has evolved her career to where she's now an AI and marketing advisor to executives and to marketing teams. Yeah. And she's going to go specific into a case study where she helped an organization essentially redo their org chart to where there are 25 marketers on the team and 25 agents on the team. But, you know, if that seems way in the future for any of our listeners, she also goes into where do you start? What's the best place to start? How do you do this thing?
She also talked about the concept of an AI teammate, which is kind of like you think about like you got some AI thing that you use versus thinking about it as a teammate. It changes perspective, but also if you start thinking about it that way, I think it changes the use cases and how you could potentially brainstorm more, of which I'm sure there are going to be many for a lot of teams. So I had a lot more questions I could have keep asking, but it was a really great conversation. So let's dive in.
Let's do it.
Lisa, thanks so much. Been looking forward to this conversation. We haven't had an AI conversation in probably 5 minutes. No, I'm kidding. No, we talk about AI a lot, but this is a really different, I think a really practical, like what's actually happening in the world and how teams are starting to take advantage of it. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here. So thrilled to join you guys today.
We don't usually get people to get their resume, but you got a really great background in what you're doing now. If you could just do a quick little like where you are and what you're doing kind of thing.
Yeah, so former big tech marketing exec, right? But decided that I want to be on my own and have an impact in a very different way. And the impact is to really help elevate the strategic value of marketing, use business as a force for good, and ensure diverse voices at every table. Ironically, AI is not in the mix. That's not part of my passion, but AI is an amplifier. So with that in mind, you know, I use it as a means to an end. And a huge part of what I do now is to elevate the strategic value of marketing by helping go-to-market teams, CMOs, CROs, CS, essentially figure out how to infuse AI in their team's work, and then transform the team so that you can have human and AIs collaborating together. So that's what I do.
It's kind of what's on the top of every CMO's mind, every marketer's mind, let's be honest. How do we infuse AI into our day-to-day? And it's gone as far as I have now seen org charts where there's like the human boxes on the org charts, and then there's the agentic boxes on the org charts. Are you seeing more and more of that?
I'm definitely seeing more and more, but it is truly a mindset and behavior shift, Simon. To think about AI as a tool and then now shifting that thinking to think about it as a teammate, it's not easy. And I have a lot of empathy and compassion for anyone and everyone going through this AI journey, right? Because no one's an expert. We're all navigating this for the first time. And if you look at the screens, the ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity screens, you get one conversation box and no instructions for what to type and what to build. So it looks like a Q&A machine, a question and answer machine, or a fancy search engine. And to go from that to knowing that you could use it as a thought partner, to knowing that you now can use it as a teammate, is a big shift for many. So it's not easy.
So those org charts, and we talk a little about some work that you've done, and I have seen those org charts in, like, there's a lot of theory, there's a lot of like wishful thinking, selling the dream, but you're seeing it for real and then sort of helped implement it for real. What are some of the agents or some of the pieces that are sitting in org chart that are live now driving real value for marketing teams? Because again, like content creation, like I'm going to imagine now that folks that are out there looking for full-time gigs as content marketers are probably having a very hard time. Although AI fluency probably helps. But what are some of those use cases that are showing up in the org chart that are like driving value right now versus sort of like, it's there, but maybe 6 months?
I think it might be helpful to first define what an AI teammate is. These boxes, right? They could be custom GPTs or Gemini Gems, Claude projects, or even Glean apps or Copilot GPTs. They're basically AIs that the human beings build, maintain, and manage to do a very specific task. And oftentimes, these GPTs are doing the mundane and repetitive things. So it's the stuff that human beings really don't like to do as much, right? Back to your question of what are some of these real things that are making an impact. So let's just take product marketing. I know a product marketing team that has a competitive analyzer. They have a competitive battle card builder. They have a pitch deck builder. They also have a market analyzer. So that's in product marketing. In campaigns and demand gen, they have a performance analyzer. They have a content mapper to map content to the buyer's journey. And they also have a campaign strategist that they use as a thought partner. They banter with it, right? To ensure that they've got a strategy that will resonate with the market. So when we think about these AIs as teammates, they're actually within the workflow. They're part of the process. It's not just using them for a specific function. There's a workflow and we insert them wherever is necessary within that workflow. So it's truly like a teammate. And for the most part, you know, there are some teammates, AI teammates, that are just for personal use. So people create their digital twins and it helps write in their own voice and those types of things. It helps find their blind spots and makes their work better. But many of these custom GPTs, to your point, Adam, you know, where do they make the most impact is when you start sharing them. Where, let's say, you've got a team of people and you have expertise in a specific area, you begin to democratize your expertise because you're now sharing the GPT with others. They don't have to prompt it and put in all of the data because you've already done that for them. You're now helping them, you know, expand their expertise because you're sharing it across. And when we think about sharing, it's not just within your team, it's across marketing. And now I'm seeing teams actually build GPTs that go beyond marketing. You go from campaign development GPT, that it becomes a sales enablement GPT. Sales is now using it. And then there's a GPT for sales feedback. And that feedback comes back to marketing. You've now created a whole new workflow that's cross-functional in nature.
There's still not, like, you've got folks like you that are doing work in consulting, but it's still very much like the wild, wild west of, I sign up for this tool, I play with this tool, I'm thinking about the use case, how do I build it? And it's ridiculously overwhelming because the technology is really so far ahead of where we even know to use it. The question I have too is, in a particular team, how do you identify what use case is the one to go after first or the one that's like, that is smack dab, right? Let's go right there because if there's value, like how do you go through that process to really figure that out?
I'll share with you three approaches. The right approach could be a combination of these three. But the first one is identify and align use cases to strategic initiatives. So oftentimes a CMO or a marketing leader has 3 to 5 strategic initiatives. Well, to the extent that we could create jobs to be done and align those use cases to those strategic initiatives, I believe that we will be able to drive adoption faster. Because those strategic initiatives have owners, they have budget, they have KPIs, goals, timelines, resources, and oftentimes they have the eyes of the executive team, sometimes even the board. When you've got that kind of governance and that kind of visibility, people want to make that successful, right? So pick the ones that are aligned to those and make it happen. Plus, it's the one that's going to have the biggest impact in the business. That's why it's a strategic initiative. So that's one of the ones that I've seen work. The other one is pick an area of pain, the greatest pain. And it could be one, two, or three areas. One of the CMOs that I worked with, the greatest area of pain was localization and translation. She and her team were having to translate all of the customer-facing materials into 8 different languages, literally spending tens of thousands of dollars a month on localization and translation with an agency. It was taking weeks and even months to do these things, right? So some of their first GPTs were translation GPTs. Field marketers in Germany and in Spain were creating these GPTs. And then ultimately, they no longer needed the agency. They were doing this in-house. Now, was it perfect? No, but it got them 80 to 90% there. Still human oversight on top of it, making sure that it is localized in the right way. But it's no longer costing them tens of thousands of dollars a month and months of work to do these translations, which was wholly a huge part of what they do because it's a global company, right? Another CMO that I worked with, their biggest problem was they had no copywriters, none, zero. Not in-house, no agencies, nothing. There were no resources in that area and there was no budget to bring in those kind of resources. So one of their top GPTs was copywriting. And that was used all across all of marketing, from web to product marketing to campaigns, content, you name it, right? And that was a very significant shift for that team. In fact, it worked so well that they were able to achieve like 75% faster content creation as a result compared to when they had human copywriters. And then the third approach that I've seen worked really well is, you know, lean into your trailblazers. My gosh, these are like the most curious ones out there, right? They are leaning in, they are creating, they are seeing the problems and beginning to build these GPTs, make them shine. I believe that they are the ones that are going to inspire others. You know, they're going to drive momentum. And when others see what they can do and how it can truly help not just the business, but their own work, hey, it's making me faster. I'm more effective, not just efficient. I'm actually innovating because I'm now thinking about the workflows in different ways. The others are like, hey, I wanna have what she's having. So they start saying, hey, help me create a GPT. So those are like three of the ways that I've seen really work in teams. And there's no one perfect way. And oftentimes it's a combination, but it's worked so far.
Lisa, I think every listener on, you know, the podcast is dabbling at least in AI, right? And every organization has folks who are doing their thing on their own and they're dabbling in AI, they're using it for a specific use case. I'd love to dig into a specific case study of yours where there was a 45-person team that you worked with, and in the end, what you ended up with was a 20-person team and then an additional, was it 25 agents? On that org chart, that is way more than dabbling. That is a full-on transformation. And so talk to us about the how, the impact, even considerations for companies that are looking to go down a journey similar to that.
And you know what was interesting about this case study is it didn't start out as, you know, an AI endeavor, right? It was truly a business challenge. You know, the business is going after a market that is highly competitive. It's the same challenge that every CMO has, right? We have less resources to work with. We are driving a business towards sustained profitability and all sorts of things, right? It's hard to find the right talent. And so we turn to AI to see how it can help. And what's interesting about this journey, Saima, is it was less about AI. It was the AI piece of this was actually the easiest part. The human aspect of this was the hardest part because it was such a shift in mindset and in behavior. And you kind of went to the very end of this where the end result was we had a 45-member marketing team composed of 25 human beings and 20 AI assistants that the human beings built. That was back in January. Now they have roughly 63 AIs as part of this team. And then this summer, they're anticipating over 100 AIs that will be part of this team. So you can imagine this team is now going to be 125 members strong, right? It just happens to be AI teammates rather than human teammates. So the biggest shift here is actually deeply understanding like the fears, the motivations, the passions of the people, because we literally have had people who were so fearful of AI that it was going to replace them, take their jobs away, that it paralyzed them. All the way to the other side of the spectrum where people were leaning in so hard on AI, using 3 or 4 models, using it for everything that they did, but didn't understand fully how to use it responsibly. And then everybody in between, right? On either side, there were risks to the business. So a huge part of this was having one-on-ones. We did a survey understanding what their fears and motivations are. We did show and tells. We also reprioritized some of their work and gave them the space to learn. This was actually one of the key learnings. We can't just add AI literacy, exploration, and experimentation because they're going to recoil. Most marketers today are already 120 to 150% tapped. And then we say, oh, by the way, you got to learn AI and you should start experimenting and sharing. They're absolutely going to revolt. They're going to recoil as a result of that, right? So there was this very thoughtful approach to taking the time, carving out the time for learning, for show and tells, for sharing, giving them the permission not just to share the successes, but also the failures. Because when you succeed, you win. When you fail, you learn. Like, that was okay, right? You know, what did ChatGPT do? What did it not do? You know, those kinds of things. And then a huge part of this was not just telling them like the features, the functions, and capabilities of AI. We had to inspire them with what's possible in their function. They had to see the use case of how it can help them do their work. I couldn't show a product marketing use case to an event marketer. That's not going to land, right? And I can't show a digital marketing use case to a demand gen person. That's not going to land. So we even did workshops by function in marketing. And then when we start transforming the thinking around, you know, teams, AI as teammates versus tools, that's when the big aha moment came to be. Because now it's not being considered as a replacement for them, but as something that can help them do their work.
The AI literacy thing, how do you structure that? Because there's so much, like you see courses popping up. You look on LinkedIn, there's some new concept or tool every day. And like my personal like weekend hackery and kind of all that. Was there some structuring of the literacy of the training or like, how did you go about that?
Here's what I say to people, because we have all very different perceptions about AI. And I always use my husband as an example, right? He's a published author of young adult sci-fi novels. He hesitates to put any of his works into ChatGPT because he fears that it's going to ingest all of that and then somebody else will be able to write the next series. But at the same time, he's also a right leg amputee due to childhood cancer. And he embraces AI from the perspective of robotics because he feels that it will change the way people work and live, especially those with disabilities, right? So the acceptance and adoption of AI varies by person, and we have to be so empathetic and respectful for wherever people are on this AI learning journey because their reasons could be very personal in nature, right? But what I say to people is, regardless of how you feel about AI, AI literacy is foundational. And I don't care if it's like a course or, you know, a podcast, like do what you can to learn it. Because when we know and understand AI, we can make better decisions for ourselves, our families, our teams, businesses, and society. When we don't understand AI, then we risk being influenced by others who may not hold the same values as we do. That's like foundational, right? And I think when I say it that way, then the guard comes down, even if they don't really want to touch it. Okay, Lisa, I just want to understand it. When they understand it, then they can make the decisions, right? So that's foundational. But the next thing really is inspiring people with AI in something that's relatable to them. If somebody showed me a finance use case, I'd be like, I don't know. I don't do that, right? How do I use that? I know that there's a lot of images and video. I tend to err more in the strategy, so I don't do a lot of that stuff. Like product marketing doesn't do a lot of videos. If you start showing them a video use case, they'll be like, that doesn't help me. But my goodness, the digital and web team, they're all about that, right? If you look at a Lego box, you want to see the finished product. That's why on the back of the Lego box, you see what it looks like. You get inspired by what's possible, and then you build. But when you're just given a bunch of really powerful Lego pieces and you don't know what to build, then it's really, really hard. I use that analogy. You know, I say it is as if OpenAI gave us a bunch of really powerful Lego pieces, but unfortunately, it came in a box that did not have a picture of what to build nor instructions for how to build it. So this whole notion of inspiring people with what's possible is all about that. Show them in something that's relatable to them.
There's companies out there that are clearly leaning in very hard, right? To the point of, you know, obviously there was an impact in the case study you mentioned of the human headcount going down with agents increasing. On the flip side, there's also marketers I speak to who want to get further into this, but are being held back a little bit by what is available within their organization or a lack of maybe an AI policy or a structured way to go about it. How would you encourage folks to make the case that they do need more support internally at a company to be able to at least get some of the efficiencies that AI can so quickly bring?
Yeah, this is one of the challenges that I see time and time again, right? Because there might be the appetite to learn, but you don't have the tools, or you don't have the right tools, which is really a challenge. And I've always said it's better to be effective than right, because everybody is going through a journey and may have to be super empathetic, right? There are reasons why IT made those decisions. There are reasons why legal made those decisions. So let me give you a very tangible example. I was working with a CMO and they wanted ChatGPT Teams license, and the company said no to ChatGPT. And I said, okay, let's understand why they're saying no. And the response was, we shouldn't be putting any sensitive company information or confidential information in any AI until we've vetted something, right? And this was about a year ago, and things have shifted. So what we decided to do was we basically said, we have a use case where the only thing that we will feed AI are the following. And the following was basically all publicly available information. And it was all like brochures, anything that on the website. We shared it with legal. We shared it with IT. We basically said, we won't put anything else beyond these. And all we need are two licenses to create a couple of GPTs to help us refine these assets. And then we were granted the two licenses based on that one use case. And in fact, the localization use case that I mentioned previously was exactly that as well. We said, we want 5 licenses. We just want to do this. Guess what? Tens of thousands of dollars was the impact, right? We saved that much money. That became our justification to do more. It's like a little bit more, but start somewhere, understand where people are at versus fighting it, give a little, and then I think over time, we will get more. So that's my guidance.
In the marketing world, so many of the use cases actually fall into that category of being information that's already out there. And again, like campaign ideation, all I think you get into analysis, okay, like, are we starting to use proprietary data for that? But even so, most of that could be anonymized. So I think we're lucky sitting in the roles that we're in. Like if you're, you know, we're sitting in finance or legal or all these different places, and they want to do the same thing. They want to experiment. They have a much harder hill to climb because there's so much proprietary data. Although this is no different than aging myself back during when software started going to the cloud, you know, and it was like, nobody was like, oh, I don't want to put my data in the cloud. And, you know, again, like some of these models training off of public data, but still it's just another transition. Again, eventually it's not even going to be an issue anymore, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that you say, you know, legal, they have a bigger hill to climb. Well, Moderna is one of the poster children for the adoption of AI. April of 2024, they had 750 GPTs, custom GPTs deployed in the company. And the first ones to get to 100% AI adoption was legal of all teams. That's amazing to me, right? So I do think we're in a little bit of a crossing the chasm phase where trust is going to come over time. Just like, you know, 20 years ago, nobody in their right mind would go into a stranger's car. But now, like, we just willingly go in there. I don't even look at the ratings. Is this a five-star driver? I'm just like walking in, right? At some point, there will be some level of trust, depending on the use case. I think more and more we will begin to cross the chasm.
There's so much more we can talk about, Lisa, but I'm cognizant of time. So I want to maybe get really tactical for a second. AI still hallucinates. You're still going to get results and you're like, oh, I know that's not true, right? Can you give us a couple of really tangible prompt examples or ways to get around maybe improving the prompt, delivering a more accurate experience, something that, you know, people today can walk away and start to use?
There's a study, I can't remember who it is by, it might have been OpenAI, that says that AI still hallucinates 30 to 80% of the time. I think you will get those kinds of numbers when you're using it as a question and answer machine. Like you're going to answer like Trivial Pursuit or Jeopardy, right? This isn't one of those where it goes to a database and it extracts an answer. It's not that. But if we're using it for more nuanced kinds of questions, like help me ideate on the strategy. Here's what I'm thinking on strategy. What are the pros and cons? The probability of hallucinations there is much, much less. It's a nuanced conversation versus I need the exact number of the population of Malta, right? Then you've got a higher probability of hallucinations there. So I tend to not use it as a Jeopardy partner or a Trivial Pursuit partner, so I don't see those hallucinations. However, still, it does hallucinate. And what I often do is I use multiple AIs in combination. So I use ChatGPT, Claude, and Gemini. Let's just say I'm working with ChatGPT. It's a thought partner. It's giving me some pros and cons about a strategy. I cut and paste that, put it into Claude. Claude, here's what we're doing with ChatGPT. I want to brainstorm with you as well. This is what ChatGPT said. What do you think? Analyze this, right? And it gives me feedback. And oftentimes they're in cahoots. Sometimes they're disagreeing. And I'm like, oh, this is awesome, because now I get two different perspectives. Cut and paste that conversation. I put it into Gemini and I say, Gemini, what do you think? That helps actually not mitigate, but lessen the probability of hallucinations, because God forbid that they all three hallucinate at the same time. I'm hoping that if one hallucinates, the other two would catch it, right? The other benefit of that is, you know, I do feel like I'm working with a team instead of me, myself, and I. And one AI assistant, I get perspectives from three.
So we have a question that we ask everybody. This is not related to AI, but it's always a fun one. What is the most ridiculous thing you've been asked to do in the course of your career? And it could be ridiculous bad or ridiculous good.
Oh, God. There's more ridiculous bad.
Those are usually more fun. They're usually fun, although scary.
I remember it so well. I used to be a product marketer. I came up from product marketing, so that is my passion. I had one salesperson that always comes to me and says, can you beautify my deck?
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't just one time. It was multiple times. And I thought, this was very early in my career. And I believe to this day that he believes that product marketing's role is to beautify the customer decks. And what's funny though is I hear stories just like this today in 2025, where product marketing is still the beautification of customer decks, which I just think is so completely ridiculous. So
I keep seeing them and I haven't played with them. All these AI presentation tools, or just have a beautification agent or beautification app on the team. It's like, here you go.
It can submit sit your deck on the PMM team. How about that? It can sit on the product marketing team.
There you go.
Oh my God.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much. This was great. And then the list of 1,000 questions, but really good.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Revenue Makers.
Do you have a revenue project you were asked to execute that had wild success? Share your story with us at sixthsense.com/revenue, and we might just ask you to come on the show. And if you don't want to miss the next episode, be sure to follow along on your favorite podcast app.